Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to August 11th, 2014 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm going to be continuing the discussion about race that you will find on my website over the last few weeks, carolynyeager.net. Some of what I'm going to be saying tonight is not easy because it gets into personalities. But then again, personalities is not something that we can avoid. We can't keep talking principles without ever naming names. But my overall theme, the crux of my concern, is our inability to deal courageously with race. We white people are very divided and confused as a people. You can say it's not our fault, but we still have to take responsibility for it. Adolf Hitler's so-called Platterhoff speech has been under discussion for these past few weeks, and there will be more on that tonight. That speech takes in the subject of Nordicism. As to Nordicism, there are strengths and weaknesses to the Nordic racial strain, as I look at it, and it's probably a good thing Germany is not all Nordic, but had several racial strains making up its people, as with Hitler himself, who was not particularly Nordic. I'm sure he had quite a bit of the Nordic in him, but I'm not a very good person to spot out what people are when it comes to these racial classifications. I'm not particularly gifted at that at all, and I don't have any experience in really looking for it, except when it's very obvious. But the more subtle things, I'm not so good at, but people are always saying, and you're always reading, that Hitler was not Nordic, and neither was Goebbels, and neither were so many of the National Socialists, most of them. And so it's all, you know, kind of a big joke they want to make it out to be, that these non-Nordics were promoting Nordicism. Well, it wasn't that way, but we'll get into a little bit of that. But I would just like to start out by saying that can you imagine the Swedes, the Danes, the Norwegians, who, in my understanding, are the Nordic people, ever developing a program against Jewry? Well, maybe at some point in their history, but certainly not in recent times at all. I can't imagine such a thing. And so I would say they have the Nordic weakness. They have the Nordic strengths and they have that Nordic weakness, which is not being able to distinguish the other from the us, basically. I got an email just late this afternoon from a friend who lives in Denmark. And he's not Danish, but he's been living there for a long time and he likes it very much. So he's well adapted there. And he wrote to me and said, yes, the Swedes and Northwest Europeans, in practice, the Scandinavians, Germans, Anglo-Saxons, Dutch, are incredibly naive, good-hearted, principled, ethical, even dogmatic when it comes to race, justice, and similar concepts. Well, that's how he sees it. And he's not a kid, and he's a pretty intelligent fellow and knows a lot of languages. So this is the way he puts it. He says, this is being abused and exploited by the enemy. This is what makes brainwashing of our people much easier. Blue-eyed people, he puts that in quotes, believe that everybody is like them, honest, good, well-intentioned. Maybe other people are not less stupid, but their reality is to fight between tribes, clans, etc. And in their eyes, all the others are like them, too. Rapacious, jealous, and treacherous. He says he's learned a lot from Professor Kevin MacDonald. We're all familiar with these thoughts and these ideas about why we are the way we are, and why we don't protect ourselves and defend our own people and our own nations better than we do, which it's getting to be where we don't do it really at all. I'll go on to something else I just saw today, this afternoon, and that is a story from WhiteGenocideProject.com that shows something that's really hard to believe, but we know it does go on. There's a university is sending out, a university in Sweden is sending out flyers to, obviously, to blacks, wherever they are, inviting them to, you know, outside of the country, probably, I don't know, are they going to Europe or to other schools somewhere, inviting them to spend a semester in Sweden in the spring of 2015 as a student at their Gustavus Adolphus College. That's who's where this flyer is coming from, and there's a picture of it, and it reads, "Do you think all Swedes are blonde and white and Christian and socially liberal?" That's in big letters. The flyer actually then states, then it says, you need to come for a semester in Sweden, spend a semester in Sweden and come to our school and learn about Sweden. Then you'll find out, I guess, from what they say, it's no longer blonde, white, Christian, and socially, and it is socially liberal, but they might think, I guess they want to get everybody to come and taste what's in Sweden and see for themselves. But then the flyer actually states down in the text, "A century ago, Sweden was still a poor, undemocratic, agricultural nation with a homogeneous population." Wow. Calling themselves poor in 1914. Well, maybe they feel they've gotten wealthier since then. I guess everyone has, but they include in that they were a homogeneous population. And obviously, Sweden, somebody in Sweden, some group of people in Sweden, some ruling elite in Sweden has decided that it's not going to be a homogeneous population any longer. And they've been trying to change this for quite a while now, probably decades. But it's such an unbelievable thing to see black people being asked to come to Sweden, one of the whitest, blondest nations on earth. It's been hard for people to take it in. It's been hard for it to be really accepted as going on, as being serious. Because it just doesn't fit. It's so counterintuitive. But there it is going on, and now it's gone so far that they just can't get enough black people there, even though there are a lot of problems, and they do mention in there that there's tensions that crop up, but these are things that just have to be, you know, when you mix populations. But these are just things that have to be worked out over time. They even say since the 1950s, immigration of laborers and refugees attracted by the positive notions of Swedish egalitarian values has turned Sweden into a booming industrial society. This sounds like the globalists have taken firm control there. You see, I don't know that it's you wonder who's behind this, but it sounds like the Swedish ruling classes, and you know, from what little I know about Sweden, they were a pretty ruthless group of people, very tough. You know, their nobility and so on, who was, you know, would wage wars and what have you, and they were involved in a lot in wars in the 1800s and. And then now they've changed into this peace-loving place where they want to have a mixture of all races and a kind of where everybody, all the animals lay down together, you know, and everything is like in some kind of a paradise, thinking that this is going to be a multicultural paradise. But instead, it's becoming more and more of a horror, but they won't admit it. And I don't know, the people in Sweden seem, except for a small minority that objects and organizes to some degree as a resistance, they have trouble doing anything about it. They mostly seem to accept it. If you read the polls and so on. And even in the resistance, it seems to constantly be beset with infiltration and problems and not ever get strong. So this is, as all people who care about the white race remaining on Earth as a kind of force it should be, this is really quite appalling. But we keep hearing about it and have no idea what to do about it, because the people who are there in that country and the people being affected are the ones that have to do something. But why are they so unable to resist? Well, at bottom, I think it's a fear of offending the other. But as this friend of mine said, it's just, as he points to Kevin McDonald as saying, it's just in their nature to trust people and think that they're the same as themselves. So you think they can learn, though. They're intelligent people, and after a couple of generations of this going on, they can see that they're not like themselves, but they continue to be told that you just have to give them time. You know, you have to give them a chance. It takes time to make these adjustments, and in time it will all work out. And Swedish people, obviously, like so many other white peoples, have been brainwashed into thinking that to be an all-white nation and society is not a good thing, and it's an impoverished thing. They have actually talked about their poverty at that time. So, and I think they meant that too. They meant to imply that too. Now, I had the thought that white people have or are in the process of opting out of wanting to rule the world or be in charge of the world or look after the world. They're tired, maybe. Maybe they're just too guilt-ridden, and maybe there was too much cost and too little gain from doing it. But I'm probably wrong in that. But I tend to wonder if they're just not willing to. We're just not willing to turn it over to the Jews, who seem to have a taste and some stomach for it, and let them do it. These are just some questions that I ask, but I want to, some statements that I would make about this is that the Jew cannot be assimilated, and neither can any non-white, non-Aryan be assimilated, truly assimilated into a white Aryan population or society. It just cannot be done. It will never be done. So all this talk about assimilation is just a false belief, or it's a trick to keep the thing going, waiting for the assimilation to take place. And true races can't assimilate into one another. So therefore, we have to uphold the respect for race as a reality. And really, my theme tonight is those who are giving up on the idea of race as a reality, or never did have it, or have never really made up their mind about it, and are walking away from it more and more. You know, we can't allow disrespect for race to continue and keep a sane world, or a world where white people can survive, because we are the ones who need to hold on to a first place position in the world, or without that, we will be done in by the other races. So where civilization can survive, white people have to survive, because without white people, there's not going to be the kind of civilization that we have provided. It will revert to a kind of religious dogma at the best, you know, and be very totalitarian in that way, you know, that you have to succumb to these religious dogmatic teachings, and that's it. No question about it. No choices about it. And so, speaking about the Jew, I'm just going through some thoughts that I've had as before I really get into this, is that the Jew is not just another instance of racism. No, I see that the Jew is unique in the world. There's nobody else like the Jew. And so what I mean by that is that you can't say, well, Israel is racist and just another racist group of people. Jews are just another racist group of people. There's a lot of racism in the world. But Jews are not like anybody else. And Israel is representative of the Jew and Jewish racism. There's a lot of anger at Israel now over what they're doing to Gaza. It's all very justified. It's building up, but it never seems to build up enough to blow up and, you know, really cause some damage to Israel. It's always being contained. But in this way I see it, Israel is representative of the Jew. Only the Jew would create what Israel is. And what we see in Israel is Jewish racism. It's not the racism of any other nation. It's not the racism of any other race or people. Nobody else carries out racism the way the Jews do. So you can't compare it to others. Upholding the reality of race in this world doesn't lead to the reality of Israel. You know, obvious. We talk about race being a reality and wanting to uphold race as a reality, it doesn't lead to Israel. It doesn't make us like the Israelis. But Jews are what lead to the reality of Israel. See, Israel is the way it is because it's a Jewish state. So we shouldn't blame concepts for what people do. It's not the concept of racism. It's what people do in the name of, or people do that we call racism, which just goes to prove the reality of race, really, because people are racially different and behave accordingly as to their race. And although in every race there's exceptions, you see, there are always exceptions. Because there's exceptions, people will point to these exceptions and say, well, that isn't true because look here, look at so-and-so, and look at this person here, and look at that. Well, there's always exceptions. Exceptions prove the rule. And the rule is that race is a reality, and people behave according to race, according to their race. And this is something that the modern world, the modern Jewish-controlled world, totally rejects, except when it comes to themselves. It's just funny how they get away with that. Now, a few comments on internationalism. You know, what I'm observing now, what's bothering me, is that there's a desire, as I see it, to create an international national socialism. This is true. If you take a look at it, that's exactly what's going on. And all of the enemies of Hitler's Reich, including the Germans within the Reich, who were enemies, for example, the White Rose, generals and officers who turned out to be traitors, who were dealing with the opponents in the war, trying to work with them rather than with their own government. Then there were the clergymen of all sorts. There were the communists and the liberals. All of these people within Germany, Germans within Germany, were internationalists at heart. They are more concerned with having the favor of foreigners of the rest of the world than they were with the favor of the German people and their lives. You know, it's that they cared more what the rest of the world thought about them than how the German people were doing in their lives. They didn't have that feeling for the German people that the Third Reich was based on. These people resisted this, and they didn't go along with it, and they continued to favor what the rest of the world was seeing when they looked at Germany. So, you know, they were despising their own and sacrificing their own to the benefit of the other, in essence, and in essence favoring the other over themselves. And this is what I'm talking about with the Swedes and with some people in our movements here who are, in the way that they're talking, they're doing the same thing. This to me is a problem, is a failing in the white race in general. And there's no togetherness in the white race today. And there's no, people who talk about white nationalism, the reason I have a problem with white nationalism is because it doesn't work. And there's only a few people talking about it, and the rest of the white people don't give a darn about such a thing. It's not going to take over. It's not going to win. In fact, we're not winning. None of us are winning. We're losing. And I'm very pessimistic about the future, because what I see is that race mixing is taking over. Race mixing is what's the way things are going to be. And there's going to be even less pure races. There's not going to be a distinct white race eventually, not because the way things are going, there's no resistance to it except little pockets of people talking, but not able to do anything, you know, not able to form anything, not able to raise any support and any strength in any kind of a strength. So this is the crux of it. And so many more and more people are falling into this, in my way of thinking. They want the approval of being seen as a good person, as a good guy. And today, almost everyone is convinced that the word racist is a bad word, and they don't want to be a racist. Well, there's nothing else to call when we're dealing with race. There's nothing else to call it. You know, I was thinking about how you say, well, some people call themselves a race realist. And then, but if you're thinking, what is a race realist? Saying that race is real? Okay, race is real, so what? We can still, you know, mix and match amongst races, even if race is real. So you'd have to explain yourself quite a bit as to what you mean by race realist. And then you'd end up, you know, calling yourself a racist. Anyway, so the other thing that people use is racialist. I've used that quite a bit. I used to. And I thought it seemed to be the same as racist, but I'm not sure. Because when you say a racialist, what is a racialist? Someone who, again, believe something about race, but we don't know exactly what. When you say racist, it's clear that it means that you think that races are important, and kind of implies that you think races are distinct and should live in a distinct manner, should live separate from one another. That doesn't mean that people of different races can't join with one another in different endeavors, and can't communicate, and can't meet together, and can't do things, and can't work out things, and can't belong to things together. But they don't live in the same space, and they don't mix their cultures to such a degree, and they don't try to say that somebody of a totally different culture can assimilate into the other culture. So it seems to me that what needs to be done is that racist people need to stand up and not be frightened of that word. But it's like all these words. It's like the word Holocaust denier that some people are so afraid of. It's like the word that I already brought up, anti-Semite, that people are so afraid of. And then racist people are maybe even more afraid of that than anything else. So we have people who, amongst us, who say that they believe in their white nationalists and so on, but they refuse to be racist, and they start talking overly friendly with people of other races and promote these people and are concerned about these people and want to help these people, and on and on they go. Because they think they're some kind of supermen. A lot of these white nationalists think they're supermen, and they can, you know, they're capable of everything, and yet they're hardly capable of accomplishing one little thing. Not one little thing do they accomplish. So today, I'll just move on here. I saw a comment on John Friend's blog, on a blog post on John Friend's website, because I had gotten some emails and I had seen some new information about his business with being let go from being a writer for American Free Press. So I went there and looked at the comments. There was more of them, so to that particular post, and I was reading them. And this one struck me as very fitting for my program tonight, and it was written by Johnny Appleseed on August 10th. That was yesterday. And he wrote, "I am Joseph Thomas Segur, by the way, so these effing elitist assholes can quit pretending giving your real name matters. John, I saw them attack you, three agents a few months ago. The deal is the truth agents and the white nationalist agents and the CIA agents are all on the same team, and most of them hang in these well-paid-off sites you want to join." Well, I didn't know what he was talking about there, but today I thought, three agents a few months ago attacking John. I thought he might be speaking of Andre, Mike Delaney, and Scott in that deal that went down last year sometime. But I can't say, but that's what it sounds like. And he goes on, "I would recommend you stay with the people and we build a movement from the bottom. It is the only way to stay unco-opted. Also, Piper totally sounds like an ass, and the calling Sandy Hook scrutinizers losers for not believing the OCT is a dead giveaway. And unfortunately, Martin, Spingola, and Piper fail." Well, that's a lot thrown into that sentence, and I'm not sure. I don't know what the OCT is. I suppose I should, but I didn't come up with anything. But here's the important part. He says, "Join us, not them, and we need to unify all colors to resist the JWOI. That is the message they all hate. It's culture clash claimed as race clash, and it's clash intentionally set for a reason to divide. We can do better." Well, Johnny Appleseed, I think I've seen his name before, but he wrote several posts there. But he's obviously a non-white or a race-mixed person. And so his message is that all colors need to unify against the Jews. And that's the way, because it's there's no race clash. There's only a culture clash. And it's been intentionally set up to divide us. So he sees all non-Jews as being able to work together and being of the same culture, because basically against even though they're not of the same race, we're of the same culture, and we can do this, you see. So this is the kind of thing that that you run into, and this one is very blatant, but sometimes they're more subtle. But there's a lot of this call to, for one reason or another, it's often to fight the Jew, but sometimes for, you know, it's put in different ways, that color doesn't matter and race doesn't matter. And but here's all these people who aren't Jews, but, you know, who he's putting, saying, aren't worth anything. But he might be wanting to say they're Jews. Anyway, you know, somebody like this. But I'm going to go on now to something from a book. Just as a, I probably should have saved this Johnny Appleseed thing here for after I did this part. But it's hard to know where to put these things in tonight's program because it kind of goes with my opening. I have more to say about all of this as I go along, but I'm going to go now into a little item about Wilhelm Marr, or Wilhelm Marr, often called the father of anti-Semitism. I got another my monthly donation, I could say, from Dimitar yesterday or the day before, and you know, I really appreciate that from him. He's very faithful, and it's things like that that keep me believing that people are out there listening and care about it. I also got quite a number of emails this past week. But Dimitar sent me a book a couple of years ago, just as a gift. It's a large illustrated book titled The Illustrated Atlas of Jewish Civilization, and it's by a woman named Josephine Bacon. Bacon is an English name. With consultant editor Martin Gilbert, who's also English, and a lot of people know who he is. He's a Holocaust historian and a historian. In fact, he is the authorized historian for Winston Churchill. I mean, he wrote what are considered the authorized biographies of Churchill. He's written a whole lot of books, but he was considered a consultant editor for this book, and he wrote the introduction for it, and he said that he had spent a lot of time. He seems to be a pretty hard worker. He had spent a lot of time for some years making up maps of Jewish. The travels of the Jews, of the wandering Jews, you know, the Jews out there, I can't think of that word, it's not disparate, the Jews that were, left, you know, the Middle East and went wandering all around Europe and Asia and so on, where they went. And there are a whole lot of maps in this book. Obviously, they're by him. And he said there are like 40 or so, or more than that. I forget the number, but a lot of them that he did up. And I was wondering, you know, I always thought he must be Jewish, but I never could really see that he was. So, but it says in this book that I guess I looked him up on Wikipedia to find out what it said. I'm sure I've looked before, but. He was born in 1936, so he was born, after Hitler came to power. And he was, as a child, he was sent to America amongst all those English kids, to Canada, to be safe from the bombing of London and so on. And he was born to Peter and Miriam Gilbert in London. So, you know, Miriam, M-I-R-I-A-M, is so often a female Jewish name. So I take it just from that it's very likely his mother was Jewish, even if his father wasn't, which he could have been too. But I was wanting to know, his wiki page doesn't say what he is one way or another, and doesn't say that he's Jewish, but in 19, I found... This, I thought, were some big clues. In 1963, he married Helen Robinson and had a daughter with her. Now, she might not be Jewish, but I have read that a lot of Jews take the name Robinson who Jews whose name is maybe, you know, Rabinovich or something, or some one of those R, long R words, names. But whether she is or not, it's not too important, because his second and third wives were Jewish. In 1974, he married Susan Sacher, S-A-C-H-E-R, who had to be a Jew, and they had two sons. And in 2006, he married Esther Goldberg, who not only Jewish, but is a Holocaust historian. And he's still married to her. He's still living, Martin is. And he describes himself as a proud practicing Jew and a Zionist. So he calls himself a Jew. And while it's possible he wasn't raised Jewish because they wanted to fit in to English society, he may have proclaimed that and turned to that. Since he's Jewish, he's probably Jewish through his mother, at least, a little bit later. And so he's a practicing Jew, and he says so. And what got me about reading this, what got me onto Martin Gilbert, well, I got on him anyway, but then I was reading in the book, and it's the way he describes Wilhelm Marr. He said that Wilhelm Marr's father was Jewish. In fact, I'll read this. He wrote in 1873, Gartenlaube, a middle-class family magazine, German magazine, ran a series of articles that held the Jews responsible for all sorts of financial swindles. This was in 1873, and in a family magazine. And the term anti-Semitism was coined, then this is what from the book here, was coined by the virulently anti-Semitic journalist Wilhelm Marr, whose father was Jewish. And I thought, well, I never heard that he was Jewish. So I thought that was false. I think it is false. So I looked up Wilhelm Marr's Wikipedia page, and all they say about his parents, no mention of his mother, that his father was an actor and stage director. But he was born in, just some normal German place. And it does say that after high school, he joined his father in Vienna at the Burg Theater. He was employed by two Jewish firms in Vienna. And then he started a whole lot of things. Wilhelm Marr is somebody who seems to have wanted to do things but never could get them going. And he started a lot of things and they didn't pan out. And so he was getting nowhere. Anyway, he married a woman. And maybe that's why he married, because he needed the money. He married in 1854. He married the daughter of a Jewish businessman, Georgine Kallenbach, her father had renounced his faith, so he no longer called himself a Jew. But they were divorced in 1873. In 1874, he remarried a Jewish woman, Helene Behrend, who died the same year. Now, I thought it was strange that it said that he remarried her, when it never mentioned that he had ever married her, but he must have married her sometime before he married Georgine. And then she died, so maybe she was dying, and maybe because of some kind of old bond or whatever, they remarried. Or maybe it was even because he could then get her inheritance. Maybe she agreed with that for him, I have a little bit of a questioning about this Wilhelm Marr, you know, and his whole character. But so the very next year, in 1875, he married Jenny Kornick, who was the daughter of a mixed Christian Jewish couple, and they had a son then. That was his only, as far as I can see, his only child. And they were divorced 2 years later, even though they had a son. And then he married one more time, Clara Maria Kelch of Hamburg. It doesn't sound like she's Jewish. But, you know, he was kind of as he said later, he had been Philo-Semitic in his youth. So he was drawn to all these Jews. But it was already in 1848 that he was showing indications of anti-Semitism. But he wrote a pamphlet, The Way to Victory. This would have been his first one, I think, in 1879, a pamphlet, Der Weg zum Sieg, well, in English, The Way to Victory of Germanicism over Judaism. Because, you know, his other one was The Victory of Judaism over Germanicism. And that would have been his after this one. So this one in 1879, after he had divorced his second to the last wife, who he had a son with. So he was now on his own again, and now he's coming out with his anti-Semitism. And he introduced the idea that Germans and Jews were locked in a long-standing conflict, the origins of which he attributed to race, and that the Jews were winning. Now, he argued that Jewish emancipation resulting from German liberalism had allowed the Jews to control German finance and industry. Furthermore, since this conflict was based on the different qualities of the Jewish and German races, so he recognized that these that the Jews and Germans had different racial qualities that could not be resolved even by the total assimilation of the Jewish population. Well, these are the conclusions he had come to, and he had been living amongst the Jews dealing with Jews quite a bit, that assimilation was not something that could actually happen, and that the differences between the Jews and Germans were so basic that they couldn't be resolved. And he says that the struggle between Jews and Germans would only be resolved by the victory of one and the ultimate death of the other. A Jewish victory, he concluded, would result in Fini Germane, the end of the German people. To prevent this from happening, he founded the League of Anti-Semites in 1879. That's the same year I'm talking about here. We put out his pamphlet. The first German organization committed specifically to combating the alleged threat to Germany posed by the Jews and advocating their forced removal from the country. Now, you know, I was questioning this man, but sometimes it takes people who are restless and can't settle down because, you know, into bourgeois life. Because this was, takes a lot of courage, I have to say, for him to start this league and to advocate the forced removal of Jews from the country. Unless he was a plant, unless he was really working for the Jews, and there was some kind of purpose in all this that the Jews thought they could benefit from it. That's a possibility. It's come to my mind because at the end of his life, he sort of renounced his anti-Semitism. And he argued that social upheaval in Germany had been the result of the Industrial Revolution and conflict between political movements. So according to a Jew named Moshe Zimmerman, who wrote a book about it, about Marr, Marr had openly requested the Jews' pardon for having erred in isolating the problem. Well, you see, I think this may not be true. I don't know if Moshe Zimmerman has got a letter from Marr about that or not, you know, that he could show. It wasn't shown and it wasn't mentioned when I was reading about this. But what is known is that Marr published in Hamburg a final essay titled Testament of an Anti-Semite. That was his final word. And in this, he explained the history of his thinking. And he says that he originally had been a Philo-Semite, having rejected the miserable romantic madness of Germanism. He was turned off about any kind of German nationalism because of the romantic madness that was involved in it. And there was a lot of that here and there, you know. But it wasn't all like that. But anyway, that's why he says why he rejected Germanism and he was friendly toward the Jews. But he complained that he complained that modern anti-Semitism was becoming merged with German mysticism and nationalism. So there again, that's what he doesn't like. He would be anti-Semitic, but he didn't want to be confused with German mystics and these German nationalists who were overly romantic about it and not scientific about it. He didn't like that. So this is the way I'm not sure about this man, because I'm not sure if he really rejected his anti-Semitism. He just didn't want to be associated with it anymore because of the other people who were associated that he disapproved of, these people had taken it up and it kind of turned it into something along the lines of the way they thought, and he didn't want to be associated with that. So that's just a little bit of what I learned about Wilhelm Marr and Martin Gilbert today, which I thought I would mention, which came to my mind because of Dimitar, who is from Ontario, Canada. So now I'm going to move on to somebody who I was just going to mention in passing, but yesterday and today, a lot more information came to me about, you know, has come out, to not just to me, but has been put online about Friedrich Paul Berg. And I talked about Berg in conjunction with Veronica Clark a little while back, and now I'm going to talk about him again, both in conjunction with Veronica and not in conjunction with her directly anyway, because it fits my program, and I'm not an enemy of Fritz Berg, but he's saying some things that are questionable, and I'd like to question them. Of course, you know, I discovered that he has written on on the 7th. Today's the 11th. A few days ago, he wrote on Roto Forum that he doesn't care one bit about National Socialism, and he is not a racist. Now, I mentioned in my program before when I was mentioning him that I'd seen a couple of emails he had sent out deploring racism, connecting racism only with Israel and those Jews, and he wasn't a racist, and you know, things like that, as I've already expressed, bother me and cause me to think, what the hell's wrong with this person, and why does he have to put things this way? You know, I have a lot of disagreement with that kind of approach. And I have had for quite a while. I've brought this up over the last few years, here and there, now and then. But anyway, this was posted August 7th at Roto, and it was because there was a back and forth there. You know, it's a forum. It's a forum on Holocaust. It's a, what do they call it? Well, anyway, Roto Forum, but it's a Holocaust history forum, you might say. And somebody had obviously said, yeah, I know. Somebody had said, well, obviously you're a National Socialist, Fritz, you know, blah, blah, because he speaks well of Adolf Hitler. So Fritz answered this. He said, well, I do not think of myself as a National Socialist at all. National Socialist is for me an extremely vague term that does not get anyone very far, in the sense in which it is possible to understand its meaning without Hitler. That is, if you think about National Socialism without Hitler, which I don't know why you would, but that's what he's saying, it is nationalism combined with socialism, which is precisely what one has in most of the countries on this planet, including Israel and the United States. Well, the United States, in my opinion, is not nationalist at all. It's it doesn't fit the description of a nationalist. It, just because some country calls itself a nation doesn't make it nationalist. But he goes on, what makes Israel really disgusting, however, is that it is the epitome of racism. That is hardcore domination of people who do not belong to the self-chosen race. And he puts racism in all caps. I mean, he just really hates racism. He says Hitler was not a racist at all, in my opinion. There was no German race at all, as Hitler explained on several occasions, most notably in his Flatterhof speech, which is still suppressed in Germany. Germany was a combination of many races united by a common culture. Well, when he says that, that means the Jews can be a part of it if it's only races united by a common culture, in my opinion. But I'm just saying that. But he said Germany was a combination of many races united by a common culture. In some people's opinion, including mine, a great culture worth protecting, even at great cost. Here is part of that speech. And then he gives that quote that Veronica Clark gives, and that has been discussed in connection with the Flatterhof, that he said, in which he says that this people of ours, Hitler says, this people of ours are not to be defined as a race, and that is now clear to millions. They're composed not of one race, but of 2, 3, 4, and 5 different racial nuclei. Even so, it is not possible or even desirable to dismantle such a united body of people. But in the course of political development, such a solution may occur anyway. That's what Berg quotes there, and then from the speech, and then he says, the speech is entirely genuine. The original record can be seen at the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, but only if one is clever enough. I guess he's implying that Veronica Clark was clever enough to get it. You can't get it unless you're clever enough. And he said, I have no doubt that Hitler would have looked upon the European Union that is emerging today with great favor, so long as German culture is not destroyed in the process. Well, not so. Hitler would not have looked upon the European Union of today with favor, and there's no way that in this European Union that is emerging today, that German culture will not be destroyed. All the cultures are being destroyed. What they allow as culture is your landmarks, you know, your tourist sites and so on, and your certain kind of cuisine and things that you show in tourist areas of your country. But the rest of the country is not allowed to express its own feelings if they don't go along with the multicultural EU agenda. So I don't know if Fritz is talking through his hat here. You know, he really is not making much sense. As far as, I wonder if this is the place for this. Okay, well, speaking of the races of Germany, I've got some quotes from Alfred Rosenberg here. where he said, Rosenberg wrote, "No people of Europe is racially homogenous." Or maybe you pronounce it homogeneous, but I like to just say homogeneous. Also, Germany is not racially homogeneous. According to the latest research, we accept five races, all of which reveal perceptibly different types. Yeah, this is in the right place. But it is beyond question that the true culture bearer for Europe has been in the first place, the Nordic race. Great heroes, artists, founders of states have grown from this blood. This he wrote in The Myth of the 20th Century in 1930. And this is exactly what Hitler was saying in that speech in 1944, that Clark claims was some kind of new departure, some new information, some, you know, that Hitler was seeing race and Germany altogether differently, and he was open to all these other races now because he said that there Germany is made up of five different racial nuclei. Well, I'm just pointing out here that Alfred Rosenberg wrote this in 1930, and this was pretty much official National Socialist policy. And so Hitler certainly knew all that, and there was nothing new about him saying that. And even the people listening, he didn't say it as though the people were going to be shocked by it or surprised or anything. It didn't appear to be, but we don't know, really. They just applauded. It also brings up that word Herdenvolk. Rosenberg never uses the word master race, but he uses the word Herdenvolk, but only twice in The Myth of the 20th Century. And the first time, in the first case, he's referring to the Amorites, saying that somebody describes them as fair-skinned and blue-eyed. That's ancient peoples, you know, he's talking about. And secondly, quoting Victor Wallace, Victor Wallace Germain's description of the English in The Truth About Kitchener. So he's just quoting somebody else's use of that, in their description about English people. And this was also written in Myth of the 20th Century in 1930. And then finally, a quote of Rosenberg from that book. He said, "The entire East is diversified throughout. One will need to speak here of the Russian character, of the Germanized peoples of Finland, Estonia, and Lithuania, whereat also Poland has developed its clearly outlined individuality." I take this as him speaking that each of these groups of people have their own clearly outlined individuality and traits and characters and so on. So it's not like you can fit one into the other with no problem. And he's speaking of Russians, Finns, Estonians, Lithuanians, and Poles. So, moving on, we have more comments from that Roto forum. All right, I interrupted the flow of the Roto forum to give those Rosenberg quotes, but after Fritz gave his answer about not being a National Socialist and not seeing that it offers very much, then this person named Seth Serdik, who's a Holocaust believer, I figure, said to Fritz, "So what do you consider yourself, Hitlerist?" And Fritz answers, "I do not consider," again, all capitals for the not, "I do not consider myself to be a Hitlerist. Such a term is too goofy. But I am an admirer of Hitler. In my opinion, Hitler was the greatest man who ever lived. And as I have explained many times, the man who saved the world from total enslavement to communism. Although by the end of World War II, Hitler was dead and Germany was in ruins, Germany's heroic struggle against overwhelming odds saved the world from its own stupidity. The U.S. and Britain supported communism. And later, when there were some actual wars against communist expansion, the U.S. lost those wars. So thank Hitler for what little freedom you still have left. You may not have it much longer. These are things that Fritz Berg has been saying for a long time. He used to not like Hitler. He used to be kind of anti-Hitler. But somewhere along the line, and I can't say exactly when, I think when I first met him, he still was a little hesitant about Hitler. I think I remember him saying to me, criticizing Hitler big time. I think I remember that, but I don't have any, you know, I don't remember it real clearly. So, but that would have been, you know, around 2005, 2006. And in fact, when I first, I was always talking about how I met Veronica Clark because of Fritz Berg, and I would say maybe it was 2008, but it's actually 2006 for some stuff I was reading today. All this was going on in 2006, so it was earlier than what I had been saying. And usually things are, because I find it hard to believe that so much time has gone by, truthfully. So I usually see things as happening sooner in the, you know, not so far back in the past as they actually were. So what I'm trying to get at here, yeah, is that Hitler, Fritz Berg has come around to being an admirer of Hitler, and it even seems as that it has corresponded to his friendship with Clark, but I can't say that that is it or it has for sure, but it kind of seems that way to me. But he is now 100%, you know, but yet I find it strange that he can say, well, Hitler was the greatest man who ever lived. Well, that's the first time I heard him put it that way. I've heard him say the greatest man of the 20th century or something, but now he's the greatest man who ever lived. But at the same time, he doesn't care for National Socialism. Well, Hitler's whole creation was National Socialism, and what he wanted to leave to the world was National Socialism, and he was so very, very proud of it, identified himself with it, and thought and actually wanted it to be identified with him. Everything points to that. He said it enough times in many different ways. So there's something there that Berg doesn't really know Hitler very well. He doesn't understand a lot about that. He certainly, I think he understands Germany, but I don't know that he really understands Hitler and knows what he's talking about when he talks about him. But he goes on to say, I don't know if this is important, he says the Nazis really were the good guys. America's greatest generation should go to hell and burn forever. Well, that's another thing with Fritz, is that he takes sides very strongly. And, you know, there's some that are all good and others are all bad. And he's been attacking the United States for a long time. And they're just, you know, the United States was just rotten. Well, it was. It is. But, you know, He uses strong language, he has no use for the U.S., but he lives here, because if he went to Germany, he would be prosecuted, he says, for saying the things he says. So he stays here. That's one good thing about here, isn't it? So then Ralph Gordon, another poster at Roto, comes on, and he makes a sensible statement. And he says, really, Mr. Berg, I can only think that you are just being completely disingenuous for completely public relations reasons, and anyone with a brain will just assume that you are an out-and-out liar. However, I do respect you, Mr. Berg, for your efforts to expose what you believe to be the probable untruths of the exterminationist Holocaust narrative, about which I do remain agnostic. but there can surely be no doubt that you do this since you are a National Socialist, and that is quite in order in my book. I have read Hitler's Mein Kampf, and I read parts from time to time, and it is surely just absurd to say that the racialist Hitler was not racist, using that word, towards those, for example, the Jews, for a start, who as Zionists are also racist, of course, who were an obstacle to his aims. And then he says what he thinks Hitler's aims are, so I'm not putting that in there because we're not interested in his opinion. But So let's see if that is, Fritz doesn't, there's more in that thread, but Fritz never answers this Ralph Gordon. So that's just where it's left. So I brought that up because the first time I heard Fritz say that he's not a National Socialist and it doesn't make any sense to him. But he thinks Hitler is the greatest man who ever lived. So then I want to make a note here that I don't know, it's just kind of sticking it in here, but Tom Metzger has been brought up. Tom Metzger was brought up on that John Friend blog post thread, and as being somebody who attacked. Oh, he's going to come up maybe a little bit in a short while here because he attacked, he's also someone who has attacked Willis Carto, as well as Fritz Berg has attacked Willis Carto. But Tom Metzger also attacks Hitler and National Socialism, Hitler's National Socialism today. He's not so against National Socialism, but he is kind of the opposite of Berg in that he thinks that Hitler destroyed National Socialism, and of course Metzger thinks he's smarter than Adolf Hitler, but you just have to compare what Hitler accomplished with what Tom Metzger has accomplished. Now Tom Metzger, they go into the money from the order, and Tom Metzger, you see, is busy condemning Willis Carto for being a thief and trying to get a bunch of money that under false pretenses and so on, and so is Berg. But Metzger, as my understanding goes, got $250,000 from the order, which is the same amount that Miller got. I can't even think of his first name now. We know that Miller was spending it and using it. They told him to use it to build up his organization and to build up white organizations. And they told Metzger the same thing. And somebody else got money. That guy from Texas. He got the same large amount of money. That guy from Texas, who's, I can't think of his name right now, very well-known name, I didn't write anything down about him, but I'm just going to talk about Metzger now. But the same goes for him. They got that money under the same, with the same instructions of what to do with it, and yet Metzger didn't do anything with it. And I will just say, compared to Metzger, Willis Carto has done a lot with the money the money he's gotten, and he created a lot of that. He created a lot of that money himself. So the story about the inheritance coming in from this woman and all of that, I don't know, I don't dispute what Fritz Berg is saying, but I think in spite of it all, what happened, well, let me finish this here. People who get things done are okay in the long run because they've accomplished something. But as somebody who sits around acting self-righteous and like they've never, done anything wrong with these other people have, but they've never gotten anything accomplished and that you can measure in any way, shape, or form for these causes, then you have to question, you know. I don't want to spend too much time on this, so I'll just go ahead with this. That's the only way you can judge people is what they've accomplished. I just mentioned Hitler's accomplishments, and now even Carto's, far less, but still substantial accomplishments. And then we have Metzger with no accomplishments, as far as I can see, whatsoever. He took $250,000, and that money was never heard from again. Maybe he had all these debts. He had some lawsuits. Maybe he paid off his debts with it. But nobody questioned him. Nobody bothered him. But he didn't use it for the cause. And I just say that, you know, Bergen Metzger liked to attack other people, but neither one of them can handle any real responsibility. And I know that for a fact. I shouldn't say I know it for a fact, but I have experience of that with Fritz Berg. So no matter, when it comes to that IHR debacle, no matter what the truth of it is, it turned out to be a big mistake to do that lawsuit against Willis Carto. It would have been better in the long run to work it out some other way and to try to get things, try to work things out with Carto instead of these guys there, these revisionists, getting all stirred up right off the bat and deciding to go to the courts with it, because it ended up with nobody got anything, and the revisionist movement was destroyed. Maybe that was the purpose of it all. But that's the way I look at it, and I think that's the way it should be looked at. Even if Willis Carto managed to hide all that money away in a Caribbean bank or something, and the IHR was still functioning and he was still supporting it, even that would have been better than what happened by having it turned over to Mark Weber, and then what we know what happened since then. I won't go into that again. So we've got some, you know, big babies here, some immaturity, some ego, self-righteousness to an extreme degree. I just see what's going on here, kind of an immature personality. And here's then some, I've got these emails were sent out from Fritz and then from Reporter Notebook and then from Fred Tobin. I got them from all sides. But a lot of people have seen these, and it's the same old argument going back and forth about what happened with Carto and Fritz and the IHR and who's guilty and who's wrong and so on. And you might know what I'm talking about. You might not, but you can maybe find out. So that's I don't know if that is posted anywhere, but I'm not going to post it. So now I'm going to move on to the person I said a few weeks ago I did not want to talk about. I still don't want to talk about her, but I can't talk about these things without doing so. So I'm moving on to Veronica Clark, and this is my last topic for tonight, my last subject. And what I decided to do was, I'm going to critique Clark's 2009 article that appeared at the Inconvenient History Revisionist Journal, journal, on their online journal, which was titled, I got so much stuff. It's titled Adolf Hitler's Armed Forces, A Triumph for Diversity. This was the first article she wrote for Inconvenient History, was on black Nazis. And then she has expanded a lot of that stuff, and then she wrote this one because she came out with a new book which is, I think, the updated version of Black Nazis, is this triumph of diversity, which I guess she includes a lot more diversity in it. And she finds any picture on the internet of any kind of a non-white person in a German uniform of any kind, and she grabs hold of that, and she's got a whole bunch of these pictures, which is supposed to prove something, but I'm going to take a serious look at that. Before I do, the reason that my attention was drawn to that was because I was Googling something about her, I guess, and then I saw that John DeNugent had written something about her, or had something there. So I went, clicked on there. I went to John DeNugent's Democrat Republican blog, and found this, that he had reposted Clark's 2009 article, and so I could go right to the Inconvenient History version of it, which was exactly the same, of course, and see that she had that. I wasn't keeping up with her after the Black Nazi article. I knew she had one there. I probably had seen it before, but I had forgotten about it. So anyway, I was refreshed on that. And but I thought it's interesting that John Nugent is so open to, it's been such a, he's been trying to be a leader in white nationalism for the longest time. I remember too when he, and I was trying to help him when he was hoping to get, hoping for Mark Weber to be removed as chairman of the board of the IHR, and that he thought he was the best choice to take his place. And he was really lobbying for that, connecting himself up with Paul Grubach, who was pushing for that sometime back when. Now he's a big friend of the non-whites, and somebody wrote a comment, and John answered it in this way. So I'm going into this because my title for tonight's show, or my description of tonight's show, I guess, is that we have all these people in the movement who are supposed to be nationalists and white nationalists, but they're really, that you find that they're internationalists when you come right down to it, and they have all kinds of multicultural viewpoints, which they explain away in various ways. But and John is a big example here. He says, "I have several non-white volunteers." He's bragging. "And welcome all men and women of noble nature to help us Solutrians battle the psychopathocrats who afflict all races and nations. A Korean just contacted me yesterday on Facebook who admires Aryans and knows our survival is good for all God's children." Oh, isn't that just wonderful? He says, "As I gaze upon Pittsburgh, I see that the psychopaths in every race, those traitors who let in the Jew are the real enemy." Okay, it's always against that. It's not a racial thing for John anymore. It's a psychopathic thing. He says, and that's just real, really true, because he says, "Please see my webpage, blah, blah." He says, "All blacks who seek white help in managing an orderly, family-protecting, no-nonsense, safe and prosperous society for black people can turn to me. We are good organizers, and we can help, we can work out beneficial arrangements for all except the Jew." Now, here's these do-gooder whites, like John here, coming up with this thing that we're going to help black people get a society of their own and be safe, prosperous, blah, blah. How are you going to do that? He can't even do anything for white people, but he's promises stuff like this. I mean, he can't do any of it. He's completely incapable of doing anything like this. And this is the kind of thing that gets me wondering. I realize John Nugent is not in the best of what is it? It's not in, in good standing with a whole lot of white nationalists and white people, but still, he's, you know, he's considered to be a little bit on the kooky side. But still, you know, how does he explain all this to himself? He, on another page, he wrote this. A young white Slovakian and college student who totally supports my bold outreach to the African-American community, to all blacks around the world. He's got this outreach to all blacks around the world and to all people of all races who are suffering under Zionism, created this video for me. And he goes on. And, you know, John has done a lot with talking to white people from white South Africa, white South Africans, about the terrible threat from the blacks there, at the same time that he's reaching out to blacks all around the world and all other races, too. So you could say that John is another one of these blue-eyed dreamers, to be the kindest thing you can say about him, that he's another blue-eyed dreamer who thinks all people deserve a chance, and one who wants to talk big and pull in the donation money while he does nothing. So I'm sorry, John, that's the way I see it. All right, so before I start on this article by Clark, I want to point out that at its peak, the Waffen-SS represented only one-tenth the strength of the Wehrmacht, and it had only 900,000. Some people say a million, but I think that's kind of rounding out the number to make it, you know, just people like to round things out, but it's probably accurately 900,000. Men involved at any one time, not all together, but the most that was ever involved at any one time was 900,000, which is not a whole lot compared to what the Wehrmacht was, many, many millions. So this is the Waffen-SS. And it was only in the last year could half of its troops be called foreign. And that included ethnic Germans, that is, Germans living outside of Germany and had been living outside of Germany for quite a long time in many cases. They were also included in the foreign. And also they were conscripts, many of them not volunteers. So what happened was that the need for troops overcame the racial distinctions and the racial barriers that had been in place earlier. But not by much. They were still there, but there was these troops were not used for used for secondary purposes in a lot of cases. So we start out Hitler's armed forces are a triumph for diversity, and this is apparently this article. Is apparently the preface to Black Nazis. But, you know, Clark is always changing things around, and you can't keep up with it. So that's what it says here. But I've also read that Black Nazis went through two editions, and then it's no longer available. But it's come out now as this a triumph of diversity. Hitler's Armed Forces, a triumph of diversity. A different title, but it's the same story. I already told you about that, but that's, you know, something you have to keep straight if you're interested in following any of this. So she writes, even though the Germans initiated their war with a racist doctrine in mind, there's our word racist, see, one that sought to create a new order for Europe with Germany at the center, and German elites at the top of the European political and racial hierarchy, the Germans nevertheless had to scrap this racial doctrine for one that promoted internationalism and tolerated multicultural and inter-ethnic cooperation and intimate relations. Wow, really? The Germans had to scrap their racial doctrine and not only accept inter-ethnic cooperation, but inter-ethnic intimate relations. That means they drop their objection to sex with other ethnic groups. This is how she starts out, you know. I don't know if this is the very start, but it's what I started out with. And then she comes up with this thing that she had a telephone interview with a German World War II survivor who she only calls with the initial G because his identity was being protected. And what he told her, she says, I was informed for the first time that foreigners who were working under forced labor contracts in Germany were essentially as free as Germans themselves. Well, you know what? Some of them were, and this has been known since back at that time. This has always been known, but she's saying she's informed for the first time. She got this fantastic information from this G that she talked to on the telephone. And she says the forced labor characterization, according to G, was misleading. Foreigners were paid for their work and allowed to bring their families to live in Germany with them. Well, I've read stories about these foreigners that came to work there, and they did have a lot of freedom. But then there's other stories where they it wasn't so nice for them. I don't think that they were ever mistreated, or they certainly weren't enslaved in any way, and they weren't actually forced. You can't force anybody. But they made it, you know, they didn't give them too many options. I don't think it should be painted as a totally pleasurable experience, because they were kind of talked into coming, sometimes kind of pushed into it, and then they weren't always happy here, you know, and there. And that's very easy. They're homesick and so on. Very easy to understand. So it wasn't all just great. But it also wasn't this terrible experience. But she's acting like that this G gave her this information, which was new and enlightening, and told us things we didn't know, which is just not true. That's, again, she's always coming out with that her information is something new and outstanding, you know, and that she is the first one to reveal it, which is never, ever the case. And she says, theory and reality in the Third Reich differed in fundamental ways. Unless we speak directly with those who lived in Europe at the time, we will never come to know what really happened between Germans and non-Germans in their day-to-day lives. This study tries to answer this unknown as best as possible, because it has been ignored or overlooked for too long. Well, it has not, see, she's making claims for herself. It has not been unknown and ignored. Other people have written about it, and because if she really didn't know about it, or she's just pretending she didn't know about it, and that it's some new information, I believe that this G is somebody she just invented. There's no need to hide the name, even especially if it's just the first name, of somebody in Germany who's telling you about foreign laborers in Germany were paid and had the same freedoms as Germans, but they didn't have all the rights of Germans at all, and in some cases they weren't allowed to go to certain places and do certain things, so they weren't as free as Germans, and there's different classes of them. So she's not even telling the truth here, and I think she made this all up to have something to say. You can always say, oh, I talked to this person named, you know, R, and but I have to protect his name, I have to protect him, so I can't tell you anything about him, and then there's no way to confirm what's being said whatsoever. And then she comes up with these disclaimers saying that she explains that she's using the term mulatto in the historical sense. This term is not intended to be racist in this context, but is merely more convenient and historically accurate to use given the subject matter. And, you know, she says, I've tried very hard to be completely objective toward the Third Reich and its leadership. So, you know, again, she doesn't want people to think that she's racist, because she's not. I've got some kind of outline for her here. I'm not going to go through that. Then she makes this flat-out statement. The Waffen-SS was largely composed of non-Germanic, volunteers. Need some water. I just say flat out, this is not true. This is not true that the Waffen-SS was, well, what does she mean largely? She uses this thing. I've complained about this before with her. I may have been the same sentence. I don't know. When you read that, you tend to think mostly composed. You think, a large number. Well, there was a large number of non-Germanic volunteers in the Waffen-SS. But how large? You see, she doesn't give anything concrete there. She's making a statement to lead you into thinking that there was more non-Germans than there really were. So let's look at this. According to Wikipedia, there were 38 divisions and many minor units that made up the Waffen-SS. At its peak, 38 divisions, approximately 1 million, it says here. Again, that approximate. Heinrich Himmler, the history of the SS, Heinrich Himmler of the Waffen-SS, Heinrich Himmler formed two new SS regiments, Germania and Deutschland, which together with the Liebstandarte and a communications unit made up what was called the SSVT. Now, this was all German. You know, this is early on. At the same time, Himmler established two schools, the Junkerschule Bad Tölz, and the Junkerschule Braunschweig for training officers to lead the new regiments. The schools used regular army training methods and used former army officers to train the SS officers. The officer candidates had to meet stringent requirements in the beginning. You had to be a minimum height of 180 centimeters, which is about 5 foot 11 inches, for the Liebstandarte. And they also had to have served some time in the ranks. Another thing they had was that religious atheists and Jews were excluded from the SS. That those are the only religions that were excluded. In 1937, Himmler wrote a letter to a pastor that an SS man's religious domination was his own personal choice. There you go. His own prayer. They weren't forced to be pagans. They weren't, Christianity wasn't outlawed. It was their own choice. But the only thing they wouldn't tolerate was atheism. He said, atheism is the only worldview or religious view that is not tolerated within the SS. Because that was the communist, that was the Bolshevik idea. And that they couldn't have anything like that, because that's what they're fighting. Now, this SSVT, Verfügungstruppe, means dispositional troops in English. It was formed in 1934, and by 1940, it had become the nucleus of the Waffen-SS. The history is that in the wake of the Polish invasion in 1939, there were four SS combat regiments, Liebstandarte, Deutschland, Germania, and Der Führer. So those are all German, 100% German. The latter three were, there's no Waffen-SS yet. They were reorganized into the SSVT division. And this was then, the SSVT was then renamed the Waffen-SS in a speech made by Adolf Hitler in July 1940. On first August, Himmler established the Kommandoamt der Waffen-SS within the new what's called FHA, Gruppenführer, Under Gruppenführer Hans Jüttner, the Totenkopf Division and other SSBT combat units were transferred to FHA control. So, still German. In December 1940, the Germania Regiment would be removed from the Waffen-Division and used to form the cadre of a new division called the SS Division Germania, comprising mostly Nordic volunteers from the newly conquered territories, Danes, Norwegians, Dutch, and Flemings. And so this was the first Waffen-SS division comprising other volunteers. And it was renamed Viking, because now the other Nordic, it included these other Northwestern Europeans. The Verfingungs division was renamed Reich in January 1941, then Das Reich in 1942. Das Reich was mainly a German division, at this time it was. And then there was the Order Police Division, was brought under Waffen-SS administration. And the Liebstandarte would be expanded to a division. So when the Waffen-SS divisions were assigned numbers much later in the war, these first formations, the Liebstandarte, Das Reich, Totenkopf, the Order Police and Viking would be recognized as divisions 1 through 5. So now it takes until it wasn't until August 1940 that SS Chief of Staff Gottlob Berger approached Himmler with the plan to recruit volunteers in the conquered territories from the ethnic German and Germanic populations. At first, Hitler had doubts about recruiting foreigners, but he was persuaded by Himmler and Berger. He gave approval for a new division to be formed from foreign nationals with German officers, and by June 1941, guess who these foreigners were? Danish and Norwegian volunteers had formed a regiment Nordland, and Dutch and Flemish volunteers had formed the regiment Westland. The two regiments, together with Germania, transferred from the Reich Division, formed the SS Division Viking. This may be a repeat of what I've already said, see, because it sounds the same, and I didn't go back and check it all out, but this could be what I've already covered, but now it doesn't hurt to cover it again. So this was the beginning of the Waffen-SS. And at this time, volunteers came forward in such numbers that the SS was forced to open a new training camp just for these foreigners. I wouldn't call them all that foreign, but, these Northwestern Europeans in Alsace-Lorraine. So we don't have any real foreigners yet. Because of heavy Waffen-SS losses in 1941 at Moscow and Kiev, now this is a sad story, but it turned out that these units, these divisions were very excited, very eager to fight, and they weren't as well trained as they could have been. The officers weren't as good as they should have been. They went at it, and they ended up losing a whole lot of their numbers. So this was not too good. But so it was by the second half of 1942 that they had to look for more of these foreign volunteers, and they began entering the ranks, for example. But listen to who they were. The 7th SS volunteer, well, they had to fill in those, so they went after more volunteers from, Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium, Flemish and the other one. Norway. And then they formed the 7th SS Volunteer Mountain Division. Prince Eugen was recruited from the Volksdeutsch, from the ethnic Germans, who were drafted under threat of punishment by the local German leadership from Croatia, Serbia, Hungary, and Romania, and used for anti-partisan operations in the Balkans. Himmler approved the introduction of formal compulsory service for the Volksdeutsch in German-occupied Serbia. So these were all ethnic Germans. You can call them foreigners if you want, because they had been living in these other countries, some for maybe a short time, some for a long time, in Croatia, Serbia, Hungary, and Romania. But they were still Germans, and that's what they wanted first, because they felt that they'd do better with Germans than with real foreigners from these countries. This program expanded further in 1943. In February, the 9th Panzer Division Hohenstaufen and its sister division, the 10th SS Panzer Division Frunzberg, were formed in France. But they have German names, so I think that they were German. Maybe Germans. They found more Germans from... they found more Germans over there, they got some from Alsace-Lorraine. But anyway, I'll just follow along here. Those were formed, and in July, the 11th SS Volunteer Panzer Grenadier Division Nordland was created from Norwegian and Danish volunteers. Now, we're talking about 1943, July. In September, saw the formation of the using volunteers from the Hitler Youth Panzer Division, Hitler Jugend. So this, again, you're still talking about Germans, not foreigners. Himmler and Berger successfully appealed to Hitler to form a Bosnian Muslim division and the 13th Waffen Mountain Division of the SS Hanschar, 1st Croatian, was the first non-Germanic division, was formed to fight Joseph Broz Tito's Yugoslav partition. Okay, this was the first non-Germanic division in in the second half of the 1943, and this was followed, and they fought in their own territory. You know, they fought in their own home ground, fighting the partisans. And then this is followed by the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division of the SS, the 1st Ukrainian, formed from volunteers from Galicia in western Ukraine. And after that, the 5th Waffen Grenadier Division of the SS, 1st Latvian, was created in 1943. Same year as the others. And then the 16th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, Reichsführer SS, was created using the Sturmbrigade Reichsführer SS, German, I would assume. The Reichsführer SS had to be German. And it was increased in size. So then the SS increased in size from 8 divisions and some brigades to 16 divisions. But, you know, the divisions were not usually up to full strength in size. I read about that some time ago, that they were creating divisions out of what they had. They were most of the time not able to come up to what was considered to be a full division, but it still was a division in the way it operated, so that's why they called it a division. And then we go to 1944, and in January, The 19th Waffen Grenadier Division was formed with Latvian conscripts. This is called the Second Latvian. And it was formed from two infantry brigades. And then the 20th Grenadier Division of the Waffen SS was, and the first Estonian was formed with general conscription in February 1944, around a cadre from the three Estonian SS volunteer brigades. Then the 21st Mountain Division of 1st Albanian was formed in March 44 from Albanian and Kosovan volunteers for anti-partisan duties in Albania and Kosovo. So again, they stayed home and, they were fighting in their home territory. They were willing to do that because they didn't like the communists, and they were willing to fight the Tito communists. And then the Waffen SS Cavalry Division followed in April. It was the 22nd SS Maria Theresia. The bulk of the soldiers were Hungarian Army Volksdeutsch conscripts transferred to the Waffen SS following an agreement between Germany and Hungary. So this was, the governments got in there and managed to get the Hungarian government to conscript, to draft the Germans that were in, the ethnic Germans that were there, and they managed to come up with what they called a cavalry division. And then the 23rd Grenadier Division, Nederland, N-E-D-E-R-L-A-N-D, Nederland, followed, was formed from the 4th SS Volunteer Panzer Grenadier Nederland, was never more than a large grenade. But there again, we have the Europeans in there, the Western Europeans. Then the 24th Waffen Gerbigs Division, their SS, was another division that was never more than a brigade size, consisting mainly of ethnic German volunteers from Italy and also volunteers from Slovenia, Croatia, Serbia, and Ukraine. And they were primarily involved in fighting partisans in the Kras region of the Alps, which is where they are all from, around there, on the frontiers of Slovenia, Italy, and Austria. Then two Hungarian divisions followed, the 25th and the 26th Grenadier Divisions, formed under the authority of the Hungarian Defense Minister at the request of Himmler. They again would have been kind of, pushed into it. I mean, they're searching for people they can put a uniform on. Then the 27th Volunteer Division, Longmark, was formed in October 1944 from Flemish volunteers. And the Flemish are a German ethnic group in Belgium. The Wallonians are the French-speaking Belgians. And so they distinguished themselves very much. They were also Wallonian. There was the 5th Volunteer Sturm Brigade Wallonian was upgraded to the 28th Grenadier Division Wallonian, but it was never more than a large brigade also. And the final new division of 1944 was the 31st Volunteer Grenadier Division, formed from conscripted Volksdeutsch, mainly from the Bocska region of Hungary. Bocska region of Hungary. So a lot of this was from these foreign areas were Volksdeutsch, and then a lot of them were the local people that were not, from these countries who were anti-communist and were willing to take up arms against the partisans, mostly in their own areas. So this is what the Waffen SS had. And, you know, I think when you look at it closely, it's not like the way, it's not as much like the way they want, certain people want to portray it. And certainly not like the way Veronica Clark portrays it, is all this diversity because they just suddenly dropped all their barriers and just accepted all foreign people into Germany and part of Germany and so on. It didn't work that way at all. And it was purely out of need, because as the war went on, they needed troops so badly. Now, here's something. I'm going to quote something here from Wikipedia. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm probably going to go over my 2 hours because I want to complete what I've got here, and I knew it was more than 2 hours, but I thought I'd just see how it went. And then I thought, well, I still had a lot of time left, but then I used it all up for something else in the beginning of the second hour. So I'm a little bit, I can't finish up in the 2 hours. So those of you who are listening live to this program, it will cut off at the end of the hour here, but I will be continuing on the recording, so the program will be go however long it goes, and you can pick up the ending after the show. Once again, I do apologize for that to my live listeners, who I appreciate very much for being out there. But that's just the way it has to be done tonight. My fault for not. But it is kind of nice not to have to end a program at a certain time if you're really not finished. So I'm going to read here another of Rosenberg's initiative was the Free Caucasus campaign was rather more successful in attracting various nationalities into the so-called Eastern Legion. So in the end, this made little difference, see? So he said that all of this attracting these different nationalities into the Eastern Legions they had success with it, but it didn't make much difference to the war. And that's the way I've always felt about it, too. One point is the East Battalions were battalion-sized units that wore German uniforms and equipment that were integrated into larger German formations. They began as the private initiatives of individual military commanders who decided to, you know, accept these people. But eventually it became formalized, and by late 1943, it was official, and they contained 427,000 volunteers and conscripts, these East Battalions, and were a force equivalent to 30 German divisions. Many were utilized in the East in Yugoslavia. Point two, the majority of East soldiers were recruited from the Soviet Union and other occupied nations of Eastern Europe. East troops frequently provided valuable anti-partisan duties, freeing up regular German forces for frontline service. The effectiveness of the East units varied, with some fighting with considerable courage, while others simply surrendered once attacked by enemy forces. In general, East troops were stationed away from critical areas and used for rear guard duties whenever possible. And that's another point, is that they weren't fighters up to anywhere close up to the level of the Germans because they didn't have the same motivation, they didn't have the same training, they didn't have the same mindset, anything. But it's true that for a lot of them, they went along with putting on the uniform and being trained and having their weapons and so on, but as soon as they found real action, they just surrendered. So they're not much good. And I think, you know, I'm such a practical and sort of a penny pincher that, you know, I think, well, think about all those uniforms that were supplied for these troops, and all the shoes and boots and all the arms that went to waste and were turned over to the enemy because these people just dropped everything and ran away or surrendered. It seems to me to be a lost cause, but at the same time, some of them did all right, and also they needed bodies there, and so they did the best they could. That's what was going on. You see, this was later in the war, and they were hard up. So you have to give these people their due. But I wouldn't, you know, go the way that Veronica Clark goes, that somehow they were so crucial. She makes out like they were crucial in everything that happened with Germany's success and so on. That's not the way it was. So continuing with Veronica's article, I had a lot of this part of it all done yesterday. And then what happened to this program was that I found so much information today, and I just wanted to include it because I thought it was relevant. I might change my mind about that, but it's already too late. So that's what's made this show be so long, because I finished it early and then I found more stuff. That's the way it goes. Anyway, continuing with Veronica Clark's article, she says, not only was Himmler ambivalent about his racial and ethnic views, but so too were many prominent Nazis. She loves that word ambivalent. See, Hitler, her whole theory now, and it gets stronger and stronger, is that Hitler was ambivalent about race. He wasn't ambivalent at all. And also about ethnicity. But he wasn't. But she's trying to make out that he was. And she says then also other Nazis were, and she includes Alfred Rosenberg in that. He wasn't ambivalent either. She says, Veronica, I have always maintained that unless the penchant for tolerance and acceptance of the other is present, no tolerance or acceptance of the other will occur in a genuine way. She says, many Nazis became great friends with non-Germans. Well, what's wrong with becoming friends? And, you know, what's the deal? Who says that you can't become friends? And this whole idea that if you're racist, that it's some condition that you absolutely hate and despise all other races and you don't want anything to do with them and you want to do them in and you want to destroy them and you want to fight against them and you want to take everything away from them. That's the way she sees racism, because she and Fritz Berg too are conflating racism with Jewish racism, with Israeli racism, you know. But that's the mistake that they make, and they're happy to make that. They're happy to do that because they want to deny that racism has any value and that it can be a good thing, or that it is a good thing. So, you know, she says Hitler and Himmler both went out of their way to accommodate their Arab Semitic volunteers. Well, I don't know how Hitler had anything to do with the volunteers, but he did the usual diplomatic niceties with the Arab leaders. It's just such a stupid thing that she says here. It's only common courtesy. And Hitler, she says, Hitler met with the Grand Mufti, but failed to meet with the Aryan leader of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt. Now, that is a stupid thing to say, because, yes, Hitler was able to meet with the Grand Mufti, but there's no way he would have met with Franklin Roosevelt. Plus they were enemies by then, and he would not have met with them, you know, he crossed the ocean. I mean, he met with all the European leaders. To just compare that Hitler met with with this Arab leader, but didn't meet with the leader of America, means something. It doesn't mean anything. And this is typical of the kind of points that she makes, and the only kind of points she makes. She only makes points like this that don't really amount to anything. She goes on to say, listen to this. From that, she jumps to this. From this example, we may conclude that Hitler was willing to contradict his own Weltanschauung in order to achieve what he needed to achieve politically and militarily. Well, you know, he didn't contradict anything because he didn't meet with Roosevelt, but he did meet, or that he met with the Grand Mufti. She calls Roosevelt an Aryan leader, and the Grand Mufti is non-Aryan. So, you know, this is supposed to mean something. It doesn't mean anything, and it certainly doesn't mean that Hitler was contradicting his Weltanschauung. Then she says, this is the kind of thing that she calls historical scholarship. Few people realize just how international were the German forces of World War II. What a lying statement. It just isn't even true. It is estimated, she says, that nearly 2 million foreign nationals served under the swastika. Well, serving under the swastika is in all kinds of ways, as it's already been pointed out, in the back areas, you know, as supply depot people, as cooks, as you know, whatever it is, that as guards and so on, in all kinds of ways like that, not necessarily fighting. So this is very misleading. And she says the most committed of the foreign volunteers found a home in the SS, until parts of it were more like a German equivalent of the French Foreign Legion than the elite of the German race. Now, what is she going by? She's writing this as what she calls her, she calls herself a historian. And this is supposed to be her historical work here, you know, her serious history that she's writing. And it's just silly, made up. It's assumptions that she makes and states, which are not even accurate, that if she says parts of it, she says parts of the SS were more like a German equivalent of the French Foreign Legion, whatever, you know. Well, sure, parts of the SS had foreigners in it, okay? Parts of it, but how many parts? What parts were they? See, she doesn't go into any kind of details. Now we come up with, we come to where she's quoting and discussing the work of Chris Bishop, who's wrote what appears to be a pretty good book, Hitler's Foreign Divisions. I read part of it that I could, and I learned something from it. I might have got part of that from him about the various divisions of the SS. But she says that I don't want to read all this. I'm trying to find out here. She says Chris Bishop and I both agree that the future German elite was not to be strictly race-based, but rather based on a combination of physiognomy, mental and physical tests, character and spirit. Well, you know what I say to that? BS. The elite was to be German always, and certainly at the very least Germanic. Chris Bishop didn't say this, but she says it, and she takes what he said and makes it seem like it agrees with her. Bishop, she says, Bishop rightly concluded, she's condoning him, rightly concluded that Himmler envisioned an aristocratic class that would combine charismatic authority with bureaucratic discipline. This, then, would typify a new human type, warrior, administrator, scholar, and leader, all in one, whose messianic mission was to repopulate Europe. Well, this is, you know, she's taking selected little words to quote from Himmler when he's talking about something. But, it's not what she makes it out to be. There is nothing about other races or ethnic groups mentioned or implied, but only about the best of the German men. When Himmler was saying these things, he was talking about Germans. But she wants to spread it out and make it apply to everyone, but he wasn't applying it to everyone. He was talking about what the SS would be in Germany and to Germans. And made up of German men. And I've got a direct quote now from Bishop's book that I just mentioned, Hitler's Foreign Divisions. And he puts it this way. He says, Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler had decreed in 1938 that non-Germans of suitable Nordic origin could enlist in the Allgemeine SS. At that point in time, the distinction between the civilian general SS, or which is the Allgemeine, the English way of saying Allgemeine SS would be general SS, not any specific division or group, versus the armed SS or the Waffen SS. But that distinction in 1938 didn't exist, Bishop says. He says, with the outbreak of war, German volunteers were plentiful, meaning to the SS. Many were attracted to Himmler's romantic dream of a race of blue-eyed blonde heroes. He mentions here specifically German volunteers. An elite formed according to laws of selection based on criteria of physiognomy, mental and physical tests, character and spirit. His aristocratic concept would combine charismatic authority with bureaucratic discipline. The SS man would represent a new human type, warrior, administrator, scholar, and leader all in one, whose messianic mission was to repopulate Europe. See, this is what Veronica is taking her sentence from. But I found it in Bishop, and she's taking certain phrases from here and trying to make out that he's implying here that this German elite was not to be strictly race-based. Well, he's not implying that at all. And as a matter of fact, he says that they were to be recruited from the cream of Hitler Youth Movement and the RAD, the Reich Labor Service, before they could be snatched up by the Wehrmacht. So he's saying, we want to get out there for our SS guys, and we want to recruit from the Hitler Youth Movement and from those great people who are in the RAD, the Reich Labor Service. There are some great-looking people in there. So that's what he's talking about. And Bishop, she's misrepresenting what Bishop wrote here. And she goes on to say, in private, Hitler promoted a nearly identical vision to that of Himmler with regard to a future German Corps leadership to Otto Wagner. So she's saying, she's trying to make out that, without telling you exactly what he said, that when he was talking that in Otto Wagner's autobiography or memoir, I guess you'd call it a memoir, of his time with Hitler, that Hitler was promoting the same vision about a future German Corps leadership. But she says, however, in contrast to Himmler, Hitler tended to emphasize character, honor, and merit over biology at that time and later on in 1944. Well, I'll call that false, too, because I don't know where in the book she's referring to, because she doesn't say, you see. I have the book. I read it. But she doesn't say where Hitler did this in this book. She just says that he did it, that he tended to emphasize character, honor, and merit over biology. Well, again, she's just saying falsehoods, because While Hitler certainly emphasized character, honor, and merit, he didn't necessarily emphasize it over biology. She just dreams that. She imagines that. Going back to this Chris Bishop, he also wrote, as far back as November 1937, Hitler explained his plans. And here's a quote from Hitler: "The aim of German policy is to secure and preserve the racial community and to enlarge it." Well, you don't see Veronica quoting this part of Chris Bishop, but this is what's in his book. And he goes on to say the foreign volunteer program remained, this is in a different, a little bit further on, not exactly following. "The foreign volunteer program remained central to the development of the Waffen-SS, but the value of the non-German contribution to the war in the West and in Russia ranged from excellent to very poor. The Western European volunteers offered high-grade manpower. After a generally poor start, they fought well. The SS failed to provide training grounds and officer and NCO school to accommodate them, especially in the beginning." So they had a slow start, but they finally got going and caught up. It wasn't all their fault. But then Chris Bishop says, with regard to the Eastern European volunteers, SS policy can only be seen as an unmitigated disaster. The small Finnish SS detachment Detachments were obviously good soldiers, but would have fought just as well in their own national uniforms, whatever that means. Some of the Baltic divisions also fought well, but I guess he means they didn't need to put them into German uniforms. They could have just stayed in their own uniforms. That's what he means. Then he says some of the Baltic divisions also fought well, but the remaining units range from poor to appalling, talking about the Eastern European volunteers. So, and again, here we have the Northern, the Finnish and the Estonians and the other Baltics fought well, but the others were poor to appalling. So, you know, to me, that's just what one would expect, because they weren't motivated that much, and they weren't as much of an organized people. You can talk all you want about these Negroes and these Arabs and these, Albanians and so on. Well, the Albanians were with the Wehrmacht. We're just talking about those who got into the SS. I don't know which ones to mention here. But they didn't have a very good record. They didn't do very well. But still, here we have Veronica with her Hitler's ambivalence. This is Veronica writing. Hitler displayed a marked ambivalence in the literal sense of being of two minds, her favorite expression, when it came to race and ethnic heritage. He was always willing to make racial exceptions to his own ideology. He wasn't always willing. And these exceptions were in exceptional circumstances. And didn't I say that there's always exceptions? And some of them were requested by military commanders who had part Jewish officers or one or two of them or whatever. And the SS investigating them, and they wanted exemptions for these officers because they were doing a good job, and when Hitler usually went along with it. But it wasn't, it was because it was recommended by these officers. So, she does a lot of lying here about saying what the context and tone of a conversation Hitler had, which leads her to think that you can from that say that Hitler remained open to the idea of some degree of tolerance for foreign blood within the German folk body, Volkskörper in German. You see, the tone that she is implying for Hitler is purely her idea. And Hitler never expressed such a thing. He never expressed that he was open to the idea of foreign blood within the German folk body. He always expressed the opposite to that. But she says even when he seemed adamantly against Jewish blood infusion, he continued to make exceptions. And she means for military leaders. That's I already went over that. You know, I'll also say that if you have some Jews in the military, that doesn't mean that you're going to have a Jewish blood infusion into the folk body, because they're already there. You know, they've been there in the folk body all along, and now they're serving in the military, and if they're almost all part Jewish, but here she mentions some. And she does this over and over again. So this is important to keep in mind how she uses these names. She mentions Erhard Milch and Bernhard Rogge. I asked somebody how to pronounce Rogge, R-O-G-G-E, but I didn't get an answer, or I failed to look to see if I got an answer. Later this afternoon, so I still don't know how to pronounce it, but I'm going to say Rogge, or maybe it's Rogge. Oh, boy, who knows? R-O-G-G-E. That's a new one for me, and she says, but now here we go, and then she mentions two foreigners, the Grand Mufti and Ante Pavelić, Croatian leader of the Ustasi. And you have to say, she says that these four people certainly affected Hitler's thinking on the issue of race. Well, he never said that, and why should they have affected his thinking on the issue of race? That's just something she's dreaming up in her own mind. And this is why she's not a historian. She doesn't even use sources for most of this stuff. And you don't, you know, only the easy stuff for her, she uses footnotes. Otherwise, you don't, it's just her opinion coming forth, which is not even based on anything. Now, in the first place, it's already been shown, and I've gone along with it. I've done a program on it, that Erhard Milch, the most famous supposed high-level Jewish military man in the German army, he was second in command under Goering in the Luftwaffe, was not a Jew. He was not a Jew. He grew up with a father who they discovered was actually Jewish, but it turned out that this man was not his father after all. So he was not a Jew. He certainly didn't look like one either. And this Bernhard Rogge was very high up in the Kriegsmarine, Dönitz liked him very much. But he was only one quarter Jewish, and he didn't even know he was Jewish until his background was investigated, and he found out, or I think that's where it was. But he was brought up Lutheran, and he had a grandparent who it turned out was Jewish, but his family wasn't in any way practicing Jews, and she calls him Jewish, you know, as though he was like 100% Jewish. And then she talks about this Croatian leader, Ustasi leader, as someone who changed Hitler's mind about race. I never heard of it, I don't think. So she doesn't give any kind of an example. The example that she gives is about Lawrence Dennis that she suddenly brings in, and says that Lawrence Dennis, who was a mulatto American, that he came over when he was a war correspondent or something. I'm not sure, but she says that Dennis gave the account that Hitler sat down and spoke with him one-on-one one time. And this is supposed to mean that Hitler was just so friendly with African Americans and didn't mind having them become part of the German nation. Where you see, sitting down and talking to somebody who has a reputation, and Dennis was a right-wing I don't know if he was a politician. He was a right-wing journalist, a fascist, and wrote a couple of books. He was a writer. And this means nothing, but it means something to Veronica, or she wants it to mean something. So, here's my information. Pavelic was a Roman Catholic, but at some point he became Muslim friendly. That's the only thing about Pavelic that she can be thinking of, that he became, he was supportive of Muslims. Well, he was down there in where there were a lot of Muslims. He was down there in, he was in Croatia. He was Croatian. And so this is because Hitler had dealings with him. This is supposed to make Hitler also Muslim-friendly and open to having Muslims in Germany, which he wouldn't have been, and he wasn't. She also brings up as many Jews as she can. She brings up Helmuth Wilberg, who was a half-Jew, and he was accepted. And she brings up Ernst Prager, who I couldn't find out almost hardly anything on him. And he was court-martialed. He was a troublemaker. And I know that he wasn't a full Jew at all. So going on to the platter. Here she says, I examined their motives. Speaking about all these people here, that these names she's giving that I mentioned, she then says, I examined their motives and thoughts as well as the thoughts and motives of Hitler and other Nazis in order to explain this phenomenon. What phenomenon? The phenomenon of the accepting the Jews, I think. And then she says, this was why I examined POWs, forced laborers, conscripts, and volunteers, in order to get a clearer picture as to what these men and women went through and what they thought about all of it. This was a largely ignored aspect of the Axis and World War II in general. I figured it was time to break new ground. Well, when did she do all this? When did she examine all these motives and thoughts and all these groups of people? Where's the evidence of that? And where's the writing that she's done explaining what their motives were and why all this was taking place? I don't know what she's talking about, unless she thinks that those wolf books, war wolf books, have somehow done that, and that this is what she's referring to. I have no idea, because everybody, the thing you have to realize about Veronica is that she's nuts and she'll say just about anything at any time if it suits her fancy. Then she says, upon seeing part of Hitler's Blätterhof speech of May 26, 1944, in John Lukacs' excellent biography, The Hitler of History, I decided to purchase a speech from the Institute for Contemporary History and translate it into English myself with assistance. Well, there's a lie. She didn't translate it into English herself, and she never intended to do so. She got Wilf Hine to translate it for her, and his translation is what she used. She keeps saying she couldn't use it. She had to redo it in all kinds of ways, but it's what she used. So people who have her book could compare the translation that's on my website with the translation in her book and just see whether, how much it's the same or what differences there are. If they'd want to take the trouble to do that, that would be interesting. And then write something about it. Wouldn't have to be a lot. So she says that this speech is so revealing and, she included it in the second edition of Racial Ambivalence. She included it in full in this second edition of Racial Ambivalence. I don't know what racial ambivalence is, but it seems as though this book that she finally titled Hitler's, diverse army, Triumph of Diversity, was originally titled Racial Ambivalence. This speech is one in which Hitler admits rather openly as to having been wrong about race and Volk. Now, this is really too much because he never does such a thing. He never admits to being wrong. He only says that this is what we know about our people. And as I already showed, it goes back to Alfred Rosenberg in 1930. And it probably goes back further than that because he even talks about it in Mein Kampf. Somewhere it's in Mein Kampf. I think I might have that here in my notes, or I might have seen it somewhere else, but he refers to it. So he's not saying that he was wrong about anything. So that's a really terrible, ridiculous thing for her to say. And she says, while Hitler's outlook remained Volkish nationalist, he patently admitted that the strength of the German people as a whole was the result of many different racial nuclei. Well, this is where I say he admitted this already in Mein Kampf. He did talk about this there, and it's there's no big anything about this. We know what he said, and it's not something that she wants to make out that she just discovered in this speech that nobody was paying any attention to. Oh, she's going on. Same, the thing that I've already covered before in those programs. I'm close to the end here, folks. So in this speech, he says Hitler emphasized merit and achievement above all else. Well, we know he's always emphasized the meritocracy, always, but it was always among Germans. The most meritorious among Germans is what they were looking for, and these would be the leaders. It's not looking for foreigners. He didn't need to look beyond Germany for this leadership. She says, here's her thing. Here's her ticket into the German community. Because any individual with a Nordic bloodline could harbor the biological proclivity for leadership and organizational talent, regardless of whether he was pure German. Well, she considers herself to have a Nordic bloodline, you see, because she's shown that she's European. Her DNA test that she posted shows mostly generalized Northern European and the other half generalized Eastern European or Southern or something. That's Eastern, I guess. So that's what she is, a little bit of this, a little bit of that thing that are distinct. But mostly it's just generalized. They can't say what it is. So that doesn't make her Nordic, but I don't know who is Nordic, and I know that when you see people from Scandinavia, that they sure look Nordic. Danes are Scandinavians, as far as I know. But as we know, even though the Germans valued the Nordic bloodline, when we see the pure Nordics, they're kind of they've got great people in there, but they're not able to stand up for themselves. They're not able to keep their countries from being overrun. And probably in Europe today, Germany, apart from the Eastern European countries that were under Soviet control for so long, and because nobody wants to go there because they don't offer much, probably Germany is one of the most the one that tries hardest, except for their government forcing all these Turks in. But the German people are not very welcoming to it. They're being forced to be shamed into it, and they're getting used to it more and more, which is too bad. You can get used to a lot of things, you see, and that's all it takes. It's just if you live with it long enough, it becomes normal to you. Anyway, back to Veronica. She says, if we wish to speculate, see, now she's speculating, then we can say that given this speech and Hitler's change in outlook, which he never had, had Hitler won the war, he would have been more racially accepting, since some of his best leaders and most resolved soldiers were mixed race or foreign blooded. And then she again uses Admiral Bernard Rogge, who was one quarter Jewish, Field Marshal Erhard Milch, who was not Jewish at all, and Leon de Grel of the SS Wallonie Division. Well, you know, I can just say a big BS to this. This is so misleading. This is so dishonest. You know, the way she puts these things together and then pretends like they mean something, she says that historians don't accept her. Why? It's because she tries to say that they don't accept her because she's so she doesn't follow the party line with historians. They wouldn't accept her anyway because she's such a lousy historian. She doesn't even live up to the name of a historian. She's not a historian. You know, just because she's got this master's degree in military history from this questionable university, doesn't make her into a historian. And just because she's written 10 or 15 books, which are mostly translations that other people have done for stories that various people have written about their lives and their experiences, that doesn't make her a real historian. And she doesn't know how to figure out from information how to put things together to give a convincing picture of history. It's completely unconvincing. So now she says, finishing up here, oh God, she starts talking about hyper-racism. She's talking about hyper-racism, so I'm going to skip that. I'm going to go here to, you know, she ends up by talking about how Hitler was not in control anyway in the last couple of years, and particularly, you know, in the last year. She says Hitler himself seems to have faded as far as power politics was concerned. So she's trying to play down Hitler as being just a nice guy who remained a moral inspiration for the German people, but he was not actually running things anymore. The people who were running things, she says, were Bormann and Himmler. She hates both of them, along with the Gestapo and the security, the Sicherheitsdienst, the security thing that was under Heydrich while he was still alive. And the police, and the security police, the regular police and the security police, and that Bormann and Himmler had usurped most of Hitler's actual power, and in the final 2 years of the war, think about that long. Though Hitler maintained the final say in most military and political justice matters, but he had the final say, but he wasn't hands on at all. So he retained the loyalty of the lower echelons. But he had lost a great deal of influence when it came to the higher ranks of the Wehrmacht and other elite cliques. As many already know, Himmler and Goering both betrayed Hitler in the end. Well, I don't think Goering betrayed Hitler. but Hitler saw it that way. Her end point is, the Nazis never racially segregated their troops. Blacks, Slavs, Asians, and Arabs fought shoulder to shoulder with Germans. Well, what does she mean by that? That's just a misleading statement if I ever saw one. Why were there all these different divisions with the different names for these different groups to be a part of if they were fighting shoulder to shoulder? You know, if they were in the same area, then that is, I guess, is what she considers to be shoulder to shoulder. And she includes the blacks in there as though there was really blacks fighting with the Germans. That these blacks were just some oddball groups that they put together. Maybe she's calling North Africans. There were some North Africans, not very much of that, and they were down there and in their area, you know, that got uniforms and so on. But they never played a real role. They didn't make any real difference to it all. You know, it was something that was good publicity and something that was good for the Germans to have connections and friends and so on, and friendly governments on their side. But as far as fighting quality, these groups didn't accomplish anything. So, ladies and gentlemen, I don't really have an ending here. I didn't work out a summing up for this program. So I don't want to spend too much time without anything in particular to say, but what I'd like to sum up a little bit by saying that to make sense of all this that I presented, that to me, what the point of it all is that this desire among so many people to play down race now, and of course I've been talking about Clark, and then along with her now, Berg, he put himself in there, actually, about what she's doing. But there are a lot of others, and I've just kind of touched on a few examples of others who also play down race and are wanting to play down race. And I don't know if it's if it's a white people's weakness that they're not able to hold firm on race with all these different people, different races in the world, and different people, and they can't bear to feel that they don't like some people. It's not about liking people, you know. It's not about that at all. They can't bear not to just jump in with all the rest of the world into the and all swim along together in the same big old pool or something. They just can't seem to do it. And my point is really, is there something in whites that makes this impossible, that gives us this problem? And how much of it is this Nordic element? And because the people that are further south actually have already have done more mixing in the past, and they're already more mixed. But let's just take a look at Germany, speaking of these racial nuclei. And I did touch on this, that if Germany was all Nordic, I suppose Germany would never have it would never have produced an Adolf Hitler, would never have produced a National Socialist successful movement. It would never have, we wouldn't have any of that in our history. It does take a combination of just the right, you know, the right kind of combination of racial, what's been called here, nuclei, different groups, different racial groups with different traits, to bring about maybe the right kind of combination of people. And I could say, I would like to say, well, the Germans have that combination, but I can't say that because Germany's not doing well now with it. And, you know, everybody and anybody can be worn down. And I do think in the end that that we pretty much don't stand a chance, and that this racial mixing, this openness to multiculturalism and multiracialism has gone so far already and has taken over so much that not only is it pushed by our enemies in a way that who have a lot of power and who have the power, but it has now is now taking over among those who would at one time have been resistant to it and have lost their resistance. So it might have something to do with that, with the kind of resistance that's being, our resistance is being destroyed, like one's immune system, and we're caving into it. And I hate to see this. It's really hard to look at, but I think it needs to be looked at. And I see too many people who consider themselves, fighting for whites or something or fighting for white civilization and fighting for Europe as really not doing anything and not knowing what to do. I see us as in very, very bad shape. And one thing at least we could do is not embrace and welcome people like people who are giving the kind of message that Veronica Clark is giving, because she is really the epitome of breaking down white resistance, in my opinion. So I'm really not doing very well in explaining all this. I don't have any notes on it, so I'm going to say goodnight for now. This is the Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. It's August 11th, 2014. And thank you for being with me tonight and sticking with me through to the end. See you next time.